United Arab Emirates, a desert land mushroomed with towering skyscrapers. These glitzing structures have become the symbol of affluence and modernity Abu Dhabi is most proud of. But beneath these giant skyscrapers, on the ground, the reality is quite different. The coronavirus pandemic has thrown into sharp relief some ugly features of this dazzling desert. Abandoned by the government and their employers, many blue-collar migrant workers are now sleeping rough on the streets of one of the richest countries in the world. Whereas migrant workers are the backbone of the Emirati economy and make up about 90% of the UAE population, reports coming out of the country are not encouraging. Blue-collar migrant workers are paid low wages, have to work long hours, and often cannot afford anything but squalid dormitories, hotbeds of infectious diseases. But the country's recent economic downturn has made life even harsher for these migrant workers, as they have to sleep in parks beneath huge towers.
The Emirati government is a government that's not minded to pay attention to any kind of moral standards. This is a government that's just fueled by greed, fueled by power, fueled by status, fueled by sustaining its own luxury, and it doesn't believe that it has any duty to workers who have helped to create the wealth that they so lavishly enjoy. This is a systemic problem. It's a problem of the lack of institutions in the United Arab Emirates. I don't believe that United Arab Emirates is a real country. I don't think any of these Gulf states are real countries. They are not countries governed by laws. They're governed on the back of the whims and the fancies of the royal palaces, the royal families, and those who are in power. And that's the problem that we have. And so, as I say, this has now been exposed as corrupt, as debased, and we need some kind of international intervention. These people can't be allowed to wither on the vine.
By October 2020, more than 480,000 Indians, 60,000 Pakistanis, and 40,000 Filipinos have been repatriated since the beginning of the coronavirus outbreak. But there are many workers out of work still in the country on a no-work, no-pay basis with their employers. In the words of Ishtiaq Razik of the Sri Lankan Welfare Association, these people are very helpless. They've lost their jobs and they don't have a single penny to pay. They don't have a single penny because they have not been paid for months, relying on friends and relatives for food and money.
The Emiratis are shooting themselves in the foot, because if this is exposed, people going there see this level of poverty, then it will put people off going to Dubai. Not everyone, but many people will be put off going to Dubai if they see that their luxury is at the expense of human beings who don't have anything to even feed themselves with and don't have anywhere to sleep. People who enjoy the luxury don't usually like being reminded of the people on the other side of the window who have nothing. It tends to prick their conscience, or at least it should. And so the Emirati authorities are shooting themselves in the foot if they think that this is a problem that they don't have to attend to. They have a moral duty. They certainly have the money, they have the wealth. The question is, do they have the moral suasion in order to deploy some of that wealth to help these people?
Jamila Abdussalam is one of the migrant workers living in Satwa Park in Dubai after losing her job as a housemaid. She says the police are telling us to go to the embassy, but the embassy can't help either. One man that has organized a food handout center says the common theme for many people is no work for months, lots of liabilities, no money for accommodation, and living on one meal a day. Satwa, a rubbish-strewn park in Dubai, has now become a safe haven for many of these workers. The park is also a bitter reminder that there is no social safety net for blue-collar workers hailing from poorer countries.
Well, Dubai is a veritable heaven on earth for the rich hell on earth for the poor who built it and who exist to work in all the menial occupations that sustain it. It is an economy that is rooted in the tourist trade, and with COVID downturn and restrictions and lockdowns around the world, that trade has been grievously affected. And so you're seeing thousands and thousands of migrant workers basically kicked to the curb by the Emirati authorities, who don't give a damn about their well-being, who don't even give a damn about their humanity. They don't see them as human beings, they just see them as nothing less than cockroaches there to be exploited. And so we're seeing the exposure of the decadence and the hedonism that is a byproduct of Dubai, for which Dubai is notorious. You're seeing it as the other end of that being the human despair that is the inevitable byproduct. Whether we're talking Sodom and Gomorrah, whether we're talking Las Vegas, all these fleshpots around the world throughout history have sown, in the last analysis, human despair. And Dubai is doing the very same right now.
The shrinking economy of the UAE has so far been translated into massive unemployment, unpaid wages through failing businesses or wage theft. Whereas for those remaining in the country, this means forced homelessness and destitute. For their local employers, means saving millions of dollars. In one of its reports in October last year, entitled Migration in Reverse, the Washington Post wrote, in the UAE, for the first time in recent memory, residents saw desperate migrants begging for food or money in the streets. Others began bartering their possessions for groceries and other necessities on Facebook groups, or waiting in long lines for provisions offered by charities. Some say they are unable to pay for flights home, or cannot bear the thought of leaving with little or nothing to give to their families.
This is a one-trick pony in terms of its economic model. It's based on tourism. Dubai was created as a watering hole in the desert, a bit flesh pot in the desert. It's been inordinately successful over the years, but it's very vulnerable to any seismic shocks, such as a pandemic, such as a global economic crisis. And so the two of those things are now meeting. They've created a point of critical mass. It's a perfect storm, and Dubai is in the crosshairs of that perfect storm because its economic model is rooted in tourism. And when people are not traveling and spending money, when they can't open their bars and their hotels and their clubs, then the economy collapses. And that's what's happening right now. A lot of Westerners have bought properties over there. They'll be feeling the pinch. The value of the properties will be going down. A lot of them buy properties to rent out to holidaymakers. So it goes right down the chain. But at the bottom of the chain are these poor migrant workers who have no other resources other than what they get paid when they turn up for work. There's no work available. The employers have kicked them out. The authorities are not wanting to do anything or step in at this juncture. And so I think the whole rotten edifice is tumbling down in front of our eyes.
What has worsened the situation for millions of migrant workers is not just a pandemic, but Abu Dhabi's irresponsibility to protect their rights. Many of these workers fear to protest because their employers have threatened to revoke their visas. According to a Pakistani driver, they are paying us zero money. But what will we do? If we say anything, they will cancel our visa, send us back to Pakistan.
These people are seen as being intermensch subhumans in the scheme of things, and therefore their humanity can be dismissed out of hand as a result. Racism is a big problem in that region of the world. That is why all these migrant workers coming from these poor countries, they're treated as less than worthless, and only there to be exploited in the interests of the wealth and the privileges of these royal courts. It's a big problem. It's been a problem for decades, for years and years and years and years, for generations even. And it's manifesting right now in front of our eyes in the 21st century. It's a real disgrace, and it's an international scandal. And I do think that Western governments have to look at themselves for the way that they do their best to gain contracts, strike trade deals and so forth, sell weapons to that region.
Skyscrapers may give a land the appearance of modernity, but what makes it really civilized depends on what is going on beneath the skyscrapers.
Thank you. epic. Glory. Honor. This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
The limelight.
The U.S. war machine has become a bull in the global China shop, wielding purely destructive power to destabilize countries and wreck their economies. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Media Benjamin and Nicholas J.S. Davis. This article is published under the heading, The Decline and Fall of the American Empire. Stay tuned for the details, please. In 2004, journalist Ron Susskind quoted a Bush White House advisor, reportedly Karl Rove, as boasting, "We are an empire now, and when we act, we create our own reality." He dismissed Susskind's assumption that public policy must be rooted in their reality-based community. "We are history actors," the advisor told him, "and you, all of you, will be left to just study what we do." 16 years later, the American wars and war crimes launched by the Bush administration have only spread chaos and violence far and wide. And this historic conjunction of criminality and failure has predictably undermined America's international power and authority. Back in the imperial heartland, the political marketing industry that Roof and his colleagues were part of has had more success dividing and ruling the hearts and minds of Americans than of Iraqis, Russians, or Chinese. The irony of the Bush administration's imperial pretensions was that America has been an empire from its very founding, and that a White House staffer's political use of the term empire in 2004 was not emblematic of a new and rising empire, as he claimed, but of a decadent, declining empire stumbling blindly into an agonizing death spiral. Americans were not always so ignorant of the imperial nature of their country's ambitions. George Washington described New York as the seat of an empire, and his military campaign against British forces there as the pathway to empire. New Yorkers eagerly embraced their state's identity as the Empire State, which is still enshrined in the Empire State Building and on New York State license plates. the expansion of America's territorial sovereignty over Native American lands, the Louisiana Purchase, and the annexation of northern Mexico in the Mexican-American War built an empire that far outstripped the one that George Washington built. But that imperial expansion was more controversial than most Americans realize. 14 out of 52 U.S. senators voted against the 1848 treaty to annex most of Mexico, without which Americans might still be visiting California, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, Nevada, Utah, and most of Colorado as exotic Mexican travel spots. In the full flowering of the American Empire after the Second World War, its leaders understood the skill and subtlety required to exercise imperial power in a post-colonial world. No country fighting for independence from the UK or France was going to welcome imperial invaders from America. So America's leaders developed a system of neo-colonialism through which they exercised overarching imperial sovereignty over much of the world, while avoiding terms like empire or imperialism that would undermine their post-colonial credentials. It was left to critics like President Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana to seriously examine the imperial control that wealthy countries still exercise over nominally independent post-colonial countries like this. In his book, Neo-Colonialism, The Last Stage of Imperialism, Nkrumah condemned neo-colonialism as the worst form of imperialism. For those who practice it, he wrote, it means power without responsibility. And for those who suffer from it, it means exploitation without redress. So post-World War II, Americans grew up in carefully crafted ignorance of the very fact of American empire. And the myths, wow, when to disguise it, provide fertile soil for today's political divisions and disintegration. Trump's Make America Great Again and Biden's promise to restore American leadership are both appeals to nostalgia for the fruits of American empire. Past blame games over who lost China or Vietnam or Cuba have come home to roost in an argument over who lost America and who can somehow restore its mythical former greatness or leadership. Even as America leads the world in allowing a pandemic to ravage its people and economy, neither party's leaders are ready for a more realistic debate over how to redefine and rebuild America as a post-imperial nation in today's multipolar world. Every successful empire has expanded, ruled, and exploited its far-flung territories through a combination of economic and military power. Even in the American Empire's neo-colonial phase, the role of the U.S. military and the CIA was to kick open doors through which American businessmen could follow the flag to set up shop and develop new markets. But now, U.S. militarism and America's economic interests have diverged. Apart from a few military contractors, American businesses have not followed the flag into the ruins of Iraq or America's other current war zones in any lasting way. 18 years after the U.S. invasion, Iraq's largest trading partner is China. Instead of opening doors for American big business or supporting America's diplomatic position in the world, the U.S. war machine has become a bull in the global China shop, wielding purely destructive power to destabilize countries and wreck their economies, closing doors to economic opportunity instead of opening them, diverting resources from real needs at home and damaging America's international standing instead of enhancing it. When President Eisenhower warned against the unwarranted influence of America's military-industrial complex, he was predicting precisely this kind of dangerous dichotomy between the real economic and social needs of the American people and a war machine that costs more than the next 10 militaries in the world put together, but cannot win a war or vanquish a virus, let alone reconquer a lost empire. China and the EU have become the major trading partners of most countries in the world. The United States is still a regional economic power, but even in the South America, most countries now trade more with China. America militarism has accelerated these trends by squandering resources on weapons and wars. While China and the EU have invested in peaceful economic development and 21st century infrastructure. For example, China has built the largest high-speed rail network in the world in just 10 years, and Europe has been building and expanding its high-speed network since 1990s. But high-speed rail is still only on the drawing board in America. China has lifted 800 million people out of poverty, while America's poverty rate has barely budged in 50 years, and child poverty has increased. America still has the weakest social safety net of any developed country, and no universal healthcare system. And the inequalities of wealth and power caused by extreme neoliberalism have left half of Americans with little or no savings to live on in retirement or to weather any disruption in their lives. American leaders' insistence on siphoning off 66% of U.S. federal discretionary spending to preserve and expand a war machine that has long outlived any useful role in America's declining economic empire is a debilitating waste of resources that jeopardizes American people's future. Decades ago, Martin Luther King Jr. warned Americans that a nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. As U.S. government debates whether they can afford COVID relief, a Green New Deal, and universal health care, Americans would be wise to recognize that their only hope of transmitting this decadent, declining empire into dynamic and prosperous post-imperial nation is to rapidly and profoundly shift their national priorities from irrelevant, destructive militarism to the programs of social uplift that Dr. King called for.
Italians are in the midst of a multifaceted crisis. Italy has been hit particularly hard by the COVID-19 pandemic, with one of the highest death tolls in the world. The Eurozone's third biggest economy is meanwhile suffering from one of the worst downturns in decades. And now, political chaos triggered by the collapse of the coalition government last week is making the situation much worse. Some say it is the most perilous time for Italians since World War II. Italian President Sergio Mattarella has brought in this man to try to resolve the situation and put Italy on the right track, Mario Draghi, former head of the European Central Bank. He received a mandate earlier this week to form a new coalition government. Hopes are high for Draghi to find a way forward.
Well, Mario Draghi certainly has the experience of high-level politics and is broadly respected by both politicians and by the population. The man who famously said, whatever it takes, is broadly credited with saving the euro following the last recession in 2008-2009 and the subsequent sovereign debt crisis. So he definitely has the respect of people. Whether that then can translate into forming but maintaining a government in Italy remains to be seen.
Italy's financial markets reacted positively to his sudden arrival on the political scene. The star technocrat is extremely efficient under pressure. He steered the Eurozone through the financial crisis during his tenure as president of the European Central Bank. He is widely credited with saving both the Eurozone and the euro currency. His performance as the president of the European Central Bank became a source of national pride for Italians. The 73-year-old economist now has broad support among many major political parties. But Italian politics is a dangerous place, especially for technocrats and economists like him. After losing his Senate majority last week, Giuseppe Conte resigned as Italian prime minister. The crisis was triggered after a decision by former Prime Minister Matteo Renzi to withdraw his liberal Italia Viva party out of the centrist coalition government. Renzi was opposed to Conte's plan to spend well over 200 billion euros of EU recovery funds on the coronavirus crisis. Observers believe doubts about the outgoing government's ability to properly spend the money led to its collapse. But Draghi is widely believed to be capable of handling such sums because he is an experienced economist. But has he really got what it takes to be Italy's next prime minister? He is right now trying to unite as many political parties as he can. The former ECB chief wants to secure broad cross-party support because of the daunting challenges facing Italy.
Italy is particularly difficult to form and maintain a government. The main reason is that it usually requires a fairly broad coalition of a number of different political parties. What that does is put together people with competing ideologies or competing and differing views of how the government and indeed the country should be run. This creates a situation where the smaller parties actually have disproportionate amount of power.
So far, the centre-left Democratic Party has given him its backing. Renzi's Italia Viva party has pledged unconditional support for Draghi. Centre-right Forza Italia, former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, also suggested that it might be ready to help out. But the right-wing league insists that it will not support a government backed by Five Star. All eyes are on Draghi now. He is considered a hero for the Eurozone. Can he unite the Italians at this time of crisis?
Hezbollah said it shut down an Israeli drone near the border town of Blida. The downing of the drone comes as the Israeli military has recently intensified its violations of the Lebanese airspace as part of what Hezbollah calls an ongoing spying operation against the resistance movement. Hezbollah fighters have so far downed several unmanned Israeli aircraft over the Lebanese territory. But Tel Aviv's frequently violating Lebanon's airspace is seen by many as a flagrant violation of UN Security Council Resolution 1701 and the country's sovereignty.
I think that Israel really is disregarding territorial sovereignty in general in Lebanon, in Gaza, and other places as well, Syria, Iraq. Israel has bombed militia in Iraq, and it's also involved. It's attacked forces in Libya as well. So I don't think that Israel really cares about honoring international protocols, international law. It just, at will violate any country's territory as long as it feels it's in its interest to do so. And I think it's been violating Lebanese territory for decades, really.
But such Israeli violations are not limited to Lebanon. On Tuesday, Palestinian resistance forces downed an Israeli drone in southern Gaza and took control of it. The Israeli military confirmed one of its drones crashed in Gaza, but claimed there was, quote, no danger of information leak. On Sunday, Palestinian fighters also shot down an Israeli quadcopter, which was conducting an espionage mission over Beit Hanun crossing in Gaza's northern border with the occupied territories. The Israeli military frequently uses drones over the Gaza Strip, either to monitor and photograph Palestinian military units or bomb specified targets.
It uses drones regularly in Lebanon, I think, too, and in the Gaza Strip. It uses them for intelligence gathering. It's trying to watch what people do in those places. It's looking for militant activities that could be construed as, building missiles. It's looking for people that might be building tunnels under Gaza to defend Gaza in the next battle invasion from Israel. So these drones are an important intelligence tool for Israel. And drones are important intelligence tools for all the countries that make drones, the United States as well, and in countries where it's involved in the Middle East.
Israel does not only use drones to sneak into the Lebanese airspace. Its U.S.-made F-35 stealth jets have also violated the country's airspace multiple times. In late January, Lebanese media said the Israeli regime used F-35 and F-15 warplanes to fly over the cities of Nabatiya, Eqlimat Tufa, and Tyre. They said it was the first time F-35 jets were used on such missions and that the flights were conducted at high altitude. Israeli aircraft has routinely breached the Lebanese airspace since 2000, when the regime was forced by Hezbollah to withdraw from Lebanon's south. The Lebanese government has filed hundreds of protest letters with the UN over airspace violations by Israel since the 2000 withdrawal. The letters have failed in ending Israel's almost daily breaching of Lebanon's sovereignty. Observers say Tel Aviv's overflights could be meant to send a message to Lebanon.
Well, I think that Israel views Hezbollah in Lebanon as a prime rival and a prime opponent. So Israel continuously sends its F-16s and F-35s over Lebanon. It also sends them up to attack Syria. So I think that I don't know that they're sending a message about the drones, but I think that they really want to track what Hezbollah is doing. They want to find out what plans it has. They want to track any missiles that may be coming through Syria into Lebanon so that they can keep track of that for the next time that there's a war, an invasion by Israel of Lebanon.
Israel has waged numerous wars against regional countries since it was installed in West Asia following World War II. The regime enjoys full support from its Western creators, most notably the U.S., Britain, and France. The U.S. alone has used its veto power at the U.N. Security Council many times to shield Tel Aviv from the full force of international law. This has further emboldened the regime to continue down the path it started in 1948.
When the United Kingdom handed over control of Hong Kong back to the Chinese in July 1997, various agreements were made in order for the island to maintain some kind of autonomy. However, over two decades later, Hong Kong is very much an integral part of China, and hence why China sees all affairs surrounding the island as sovereign business. Yet, following the implementation of the National Security Law, preventing a variety of crimes, including secession, subversion, terrorism and collusion, the UK promised to issue eligible Hong Kong residents citizenship to Britain, something that Prime Minister Boris Johnson has recently reiterated he will honour. The ability for Hong Kong residents to apply for the special visa may see hundreds of thousands of people apply to travel, live and settle in the UK, and has seen immigration officers in Hong Kong see a surge in demand for applications as the process begins to fall into place. However, China has taken offence to the offer by the British, with the Chinese Foreign Affairs spokesman Zhao Linjian stating that the move grossly interferes with Chinese internal affairs. He further stated that China will no longer recognize BNO passports as valid travel documents. Furthermore, Chinese authorities are baffled as to why residents would want to leave Hong Kong and head to the UK, claiming that once they arrive there, they'll be considered as second-class citizens, something that China may very well have a point on when one considers the levels of discrimination and racism against foreigners in Britain. meaning that new arrivals could fast become targets of British anti-hospitality, something that the Brits have a long and tarnished record of. What now remains to be seen is just when and how so many new residents will make their way over to the UK, in particular as Britain faces the toughest ever travel measures amongst the peak of the COVID-19 virus, which has already killed in excess of 100,000 British people already. As Britain comes to the stark realisation that leaving the EU may have caused more problems than benefits, it seems that one thing that was not calculated was a sudden resentment towards Europeans, in particular Eastern Europeans, who made up a significant percentage of the low-skilled workforce in Britain, meaning that many EU citizens felt they were no longer welcome in the country.
During my previous 6 years in the UK, I was contributing to the economy here. I cherished Britishness. I worked in companies such as Barclays and subsequently British Airways, and most of my working life has been concentrated on public sector. And then one snap decision destroyed it all, and suddenly I felt, I actually do not belong here. I am no longer welcome.
It's hence why Britain needed to find an alternative source of labour to fill the void as Europeans leave the UK and head back to their home countries in the European Union. And hence why Boris Johnson, when asked what he would do about the Hong Kong situation, saw an opportunity waiting to be developed. Boris Johnson is no doubt using the opportunity for BNO status holders in Hong Kong to find a way into the UK, and hence why suddenly, unlike European citizens who no longer feel welcome, he claims he's proud to allow the people of Hong Kong to live and work in Britain. After all, his economy depends on having a wide range of workforces. So bad is the labour drain in Britain that the number of Europeans having left the country has seen EU citizens' levels in Britain at their lowest for over 5 years, meaning that more people are leaving Britain than actually entering the country. And with Brexit being such a dividing topic in Britain, the government have gone one step further by secretly adding EU nations to the so-called voluntary return scheme, which actually pays EU citizens to get out of Britain, covering their flight costs and also providing £2,000 in a cash envelope in the process, showing just how deep Britain's discrimination and hatred of the EU really is. What now remains to be seen is whether the people of Hong Kong are genuinely willing to fall into the trap that their Eastern European predecessors managed to escape from in Britain, and whether actually leaving Hong Kong and truly becoming second-class citizens is better than living in their own country.
The coronavirus pandemic battered the global economy like nothing else has done for decades. Prolonged nationwide lockdowns in some countries and mismanagement of the crisis in others have all contributed to 2020 becoming one of the gloomiest years for the global economy. It's not surprising to learn, according to a new report from the International Labour Organization, that workers around the world have lost $3.7 trillion since the pandemic began. Globally, 8.8% of working hours were lost, and 114 million people experienced employment loss, what the report called an unprecedented level. What's shocking is another report that made headlines. Billionaires around the world, who initially suffered massive losses like everyone else, have seen their wealth increase by $3.9 trillion as the entire globe has been grappling with the impacts of the deadly respiratory disease. That figure, according to the Oxfam report, is enough to vaccinate every single person on Earth against the coronavirus and help them stay out of poverty.
It's a new normal, but I don't think it's a sustainable new normal. So the level of increase in wealth is enormous. And it's already coming not out of the market system now, which is what caused the inequality before the financial crisis. It's now coming out of the impact of government policy. And this is really the ineffectiveness of government policy led by mainstream economists who have no idea of the role of inequality really in society. Most of their models talk about a representative agent where they lump together income from wages and income from profits as if we both receive them equally. So that level of naivety lies behind policies that believe we can revive the economies by boosting the wealth of the wealthy.
In the meantime, the workers may have to wait for a decade to be able to recover the losses they sustained. The report also estimates between 200 million to 500 million people may have fallen into poverty during 2020. Oxfam has said in its report that the world's billionaires' collective net worth is now standing at nearly $12 trillion, equivalent to what G20 countries have spent in response to the pandemic. The most vulnerable workers have faced some of the biggest job losses throughout the pandemic's recovery, and that K-shaped trajectory may continue.
They, and this is Ben Bernanke, who's on record as saying this, thought one way to revive the economy was to increase the value of shares and cause what he calls a wealth effect to encourage more spending and stimulate the economy. And I summarise that as trying to make the economy better by making the wealthy wealthier, because only a tiny fraction of the population owned shares, and that boosted their wealth without touching what happened with the remainder. Now, when COVID has struck, a very similar process is afoot. Central banks are buying bonds again, giving the financial sector large amounts of cash, which they then use to buy shares, which drives up share prices, and that's what's causing what's called the K-shaped recovery. Asset markets, particularly share markets, are skyrocketing, while at the same time, because workers can't go to work due to lockdowns and the impact of COVID, the income of workers is falling.
The International Labour Organization said there were some encouraging signs of recovery at the start of 2021, with the COVID-19 vaccine gradually being deployed around the world. However, it's still estimated the continuing economic fallout would lead to a 3% loss of working hours globally in 2021, compared with the end of 2019, equivalent to 19 million full-time jobs. In a pessimistic scenario, which assumes slow progress on vaccination, working hours would fall by 4.6% this year, while in an optimistic path, the world economy would still lose 1.3% of working hours. The outcome would depend on how well the pandemic was brought under control and by how much consumer and business confidence recovered. A slow vaccine rollout and uneven distribution could also impact the speed at which the global economy recovers. This has led the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to downgrade their respective outlooks. It seems that the only way out of the current economic situation for the governments around the world is aiming for a targeted recovery that prioritizes employment and would provide support for hard-hit workers and sectors.
The very first revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
جانم تپشم سخنم باشد وطنم وطنم ای خان که گوهر خیز بهره وطنم قدمم عشقم سخنم قسمم از عاشقی لبریز.
Congratulations on the victory anniversary of the Islamic Revolution.
Art in light of Islamic Revolution. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, today is the 8th day of the 10-day dawn, which marks the period in which the Islamic Revolution of the Iranian people triumphed over the oppressive Pahlavi regime and put an end to 2,500 years of tyranny and oppression for good. The Islamic Revolution was undoubtedly the most important event in the contemporary world and the 20th century. The victory of the Islamic Revolution has had deep impact on different aspects of Iranian people's life. This revolution enjoys characteristics and principles that have their roots in Islam. Characteristics like self-sacrifice, justice, and a struggle against oppression. In view of this, it has affected art too. Impressed by the Islamic Revolution, Iranian artists have created works that reflect pure human values. The Islamic Revolution directed artistic works toward divine and humane values. No doubt, one of the important aspects of this revolution has been to train individuals who are in pursuit of perfection and sublimity, not merely for themselves, but for their fellow humans and the entire humanity. In view of this, mention can be made of painters like Ali Vazirian and Mahmoud Farshchian, filmmakers like Ebrahim Hatamikia, Majid Majidi, Kamal Tabrizi, Narges Abyar, Abul Qasim Talibi, and Sayyid Reza Mir Karimi, poets like late Hamid Sabzevari, Sayyid Ali Musavi Garmarudi, and writers like Sayyid Mehdi Shojai. Cinema is surely among the most important branches of the art of the Islamic Revolution. This art has been known overseas as the first Iranian art. In fact, the Iranian cinema has gone through ups and downs since 1900, yet it gained momentum after the year 1979. After the victory of the Islamic Revolution, little by little, talented forces started working in playing in films, which differed much with the films made in Hollywood. Thus, cinema in Iran ushered in a very new era in which sexuality had no place and almost all works pursued lofty values. The most outstanding theorist in the field of cinema and media was martyr Sayyid Murtaza Avini. Avini was a director of documentaries who had unique views on art, cinema, and media. He described the art of the Islamic Revolution as follows. The art of the Islamic Revolution takes the format and material of the Western art, but will give it a new spirit and image. Eventually, it will be distinct from the Western art in terms of material and format. Then, in the next phases, it will try to create changes in the material and formats of art in compliance with its own spirit and commitment. Martyr Avini considered cinema as a medium to communicate concepts correctly. He has indeed founded the Islamic and revolutionary cinema. He has materialized the features of the Islamic art, namely commitment, human look, attaining the cognizance of God, and struggling against falsehood. One of the most distinct features of art after the victory of Islamic Revolution is paying attention to family and preserving the dignity and status of women. The pre-revolution cinema was an immoral arena where few women dared to enter it. But the trend changed a lot after the Islamic Revolution. Today, there are numerous actresses who have catapulted to fame both in Iran and abroad. Moreover, a considerable number of women have entered in other cinematic domains to work as writers of scripts, directing, and production. There are few cinematic events in the world where there is no work of Iranian filmmakers. Some of the Iranian filmmakers and actors have got global prize too. Iran's cinema gained Oscar reward in 2007 for the first time with the film Children of Heaven. And 12 years later, it got the same reward with the film Separation of Nader from Simin. This year, Iranian filmmaker Majid Majidi's film The Sun has participated in the event with Ruhollah Zamani as the adolescent star of the film. Among other prominent filmmakers after the Islamic Revolution, mention can be made of Cyrus Alvand and Dariush Mehrjui, who have created good works. In short, the cinematic art after the Islamic Revolution has got rid of the yoke of immorality and instrumental view on women. Although there is a long way to go yet, young filmmakers have also made precious works in recent years. Among them, one can name Mohammad Hossein Mahdavian and Bahram Tawakkuli.
Joe Biden has been inaugurated as the 46th president of the United States. Several of his cabinet appointees have also been confirmed by the Senate. So what have we learned so far from these confirmation hearings and his latest executive actions regarding both his domestic and foreign policy? Let's take a closer look. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Roughly 1 year ago, Joe Biden's candidacy looked miserable and dead in the water. He was struggling to raise money for his presidential campaign from small dollar donations and had even tapped out all his wealthy Wall Street donors. His hopes of getting into the White House didn't look very promising at all. And yet here we are 1 year later, and Joe Biden has managed by some miracle to be elected the 46th president. We heard over and over warnings from the mainstream media and politicians alike how a progressive like Bernie Sanders just wasn't going to cut it against an existential threat like Donald Trump, and that it was imperative to get someone more moderate like Joe Biden into office, and that as soon as he got into the White House, everything would be fine. So now that he's the president, what has his first week in office looked like? Well, the mainstream media wasted no time celebrating. In fact, the entire day of his inauguration was spent celebrating Trump's departure by salivating over Joe Biden and even expressing joy over former presidents Bush, Obama, and Clinton, who were also in attendance. This hysteria in the media manifested itself with several reporters referring to this reunion of war criminals as some sort of superhero event.
The sight of the Clintons and the Bushes and the Obamas, you know, the Avengers, you know, sort of the Marvel superheroes back up there together, all in one place.
It's frankly amazing how quickly the media forgets that these are the same presidents who started the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, and ruined the lives of millions of people. After this performance was finally over, the first thing Biden did as president was sign a slew of executive orders. Among them, rejoining the Paris Climate Accords, as well as the World Health Organization, which Trump had pulled out of. He reversed a few other decisions made by Trump, like the controversial Muslim ban that Trump introduced in 2017. However, what the media doesn't tell you is that this original law was crafted under Obama's presidency when Joe Biden was vice president. The Visa Waiver Program Improvement and Terrorist Child Prevention Act of 2015. This is the framework that was introduced by the Obama administration, listing countries like Iran, Syria, Iraq, Sudan as areas of concern and safe havens for terrorists, and placing hurdles for anyone who's visited these countries. Trump, of course, built on that to ban dual nationals entirely, which Biden did roll back, but he hasn't gotten rid of the original legislation from 2015, which singles out these very same countries. Now, absent among any of Biden's first moves are the $2,000 stimulus checks. We heard repeatedly throughout his presidential campaign and from Democratic candidates and politicians that as soon as Biden is elected, Americans will get $2,000 stimulus checks.
We will be able to pass $2,000 stimulus checks for the people next week.
If you send John and the Reverend to Washington, those $2,000 checks will go out the door, restoring hope and decency and honor for so many people who are struggling right now.
Well, those checks still haven't arrived. As a matter of fact, Joe Biden has tried knocking them down to $1,400, claiming that the $600 issued under Trump a few months ago is to be counted as a part of that. It's frankly mind-boggling to see the president of the richest country in the world rob his own citizens in such a way during both the pandemic and economic crisis. And even then, those checks are still no closer to being sent out or anywhere near enough and not retroactive. Now, in terms of healthcare, throughout his campaign, again, Joe Biden would say that healthcare is a human right. And keep in mind, we have millions of Americans that are unemployed, so they've also lost their health insurance as a result of that. Now, Joe Biden isn't saying that healthcare is a human right anymore. He's saying he wants to give Americans easier access to healthcare. Joe Biden has signed two executive actions, reopening enrollment for the Affordable Care Act until May. This is, again, a largely performative gesture and does not guarantee healthcare. Even if one were to sign up for the Affordable Care Act, most Americans can't afford the deductibles or out-of-pocket payments required for the insurance to kick in, making this effectively useless and leaving millions of Americans still underinsured. Biden's campaign promise to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour also seems to be out the window, with Democrats now introducing legislation aiming to push for this in the year 2025. Keep in mind, the Democrats control the House, the Senate, and the White House. And this is the best they can do? It's frankly shameful, and will leave a large portion of the working class in a dismal state with growing resentment towards Washington. Once again, we're seeing the same behavior during the Obama years when Democrats had a supermajority and refused to do anything of substance with it. Now, in terms of foreign policy, we've had some interesting developments. As expected, Joe Biden's appointee for Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, was approved by the Senate and is now the first black man to ever lead the Pentagon. Austin is another familiar face from the Obama era, serving as the head of U.S. Central Command, which oversaw things like the intervention in Syria and the occupation of Iraq. Another part of his resume that the media seems to gloss over so often is the fact that Austin sat on the board of weapons manufacturer Raytheon, which is one of the largest contractors to the U.S. military. This conflict of interest didn't seem to matter to the Senate, which overwhelmingly voted to approve him, 93-2. Once again, bipartisanship in all things war and empire. Biden's nominee for Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, had his confirmation hearing in the Senate. During a four-hour session, he was asked about a wide array of topics covering China, Venezuela, Iran, and more. Blinken, who served under Obama as Deputy Secretary of State and supported the regime change conquests in Libya and Syria, was grilled by Senator Rand Paul over his support for these failed imperialist endeavors.
Why do the wars continue? Why do the wars in Syria and Libya and Somalia and Afghanistan continue? Because the more things change, the more they stay the same. Mr. Blinken has been a full-throated advocate of military intervention in the Middle East.
Safe to say, when Joe Biden claims diversity and the media class and political class are breathing a sigh of relief, claiming a return to normalcy, their meaning of normal constitutes the same failed policies that resulted in the displacement and the deaths of countless innocents. That's what it really comes down to. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me to talk more is Rania Khalik, journalist and producer of Soapbox and Unauthorized Discussion.